Yes, hopefully this doesn't overlap too much with what Rasmus talked about last week. I'm obviously going to focus on digital, but I think in many ways we've sort of been living through the last sort of 5-10 years or so, this sort of extraordinary change. The whole sort of business of journalism has been thrown upside down. And for the last 5-6 years, we've been documenting a lot of those change with this annual survey that we do. And I'm going to share a little bit of the data from the 2017 survey, but also going back a little bit. And then the second half, because I'm also interested in technology specifically and how it's changing news and formats, I'm going to talk a little bit about what maybe might happen next. So the first bit is using the data to go backwards, and then the second bit will sort of give some thoughts about what might happen over the next 5 years or so. And as Mira said, by the way, the slides will be available afterwards, so you can look at them at your leisure. I will try not to go too fast. Feel free to interrupt as we go along, or we can have questions at the end. As ever, I put too many slides in here. I'm sorry already. It is the world's biggest news survey. We do it every year. We've done it since 2012. We started with 5 countries. We now have 36 markets where we ask about news consumption. But I wanted to start really with just looking back, actually, at what's happening in a couple of countries, just so we can sort of see the change that's happened in the last 5 or 6 years. So just starting, first of all, with the US as a not necessarily typical market, but a market we're all interested in. So firstly, you can see that the blue line at the top is online, and you can see that how over that period, online's become relatively more important. You can see how television started to get less important, but then because of the Trump campaign sort of took a bit of a rebound. So actually cable news figures are very, very high again. The big changes, though, you can see is really that the rise of social media, which has pretty much doubled as a source of news, obviously within that online section. So from about 32% to almost 60% of people saying that they use social media for news. And then the decline of print, which obviously started much earlier. One of the things we've discovered, though, that is that not every country is like the United States. So quite often the debate across the world with digital is that the states, you know, everything that happens in the states is going to happen everywhere else. And there's a lot of reasons why I think that isn't the case, to do with culture, to do with regulation, to do with media systems. And just to take one example, this is Germany. So Germany is, of course, as connected as the United States in terms of internet penetration. But you can see here that television is still by far the most important source of news, much more than the internet. And so a lot of people in Germany, for cultural and all kinds of reasons, still sit down and watch an evening bulletin, often together as a family. Now, that is declining, so some of the same trends, but it's much higher than in many other countries. The other interesting thing is that online has hardly grown in Germany, so still only just over 60% of Germans, even though they're very connected, say they're using online for news at least once a week. And that hasn't grown very much. So different countries are different for different reasons. But you can see those other trends. Germany had, when we started our surveys, incredibly high, one of the highest print circulations and readerships in our survey. And you can see how fast that's fallen in 5 years. That's the purple line. And then the same growth in social media, but much lower levels. So again, when we look at why there's such discussion about the role of social media in the US elections compared with the German elections, you can see that there is a big difference between the two of them. The other thing just at the beginning in terms of habits, which I think has come out of our data year on year, is the difference in terms of what we prefer. So these preferences, these generational preferences. So younger people on the whole essentially prefer online news and social media. Older people prefer, so that's the green line and the purple line, prefer traditional media sources, particularly television news, but also to an extent radio and newspapers. So this generational split. And oddly, over the 5 years, we haven't seen much shift with those older demographics. Older people basically have their habits. I still buy a newspaper every day. I don't read it as much as I used to, but I still buy it. And I still, where I can, sit down and watch television news bulletin. And I've grafted on top of that all these digital habits. For younger people, they kind of born digital, and then they might pick up a free newspaper, or they might watch television if they're around. These are very, very different behaviours. And it makes it really hard for media organizations to deal with these divergent. It's very expensive. You have to produce content in more formats, all the rest of it. So I think this is something to bear in mind, is just these generational differences. So now, particularly young people, as you know, are scrolling through social media feeds. And for many of them, that is now the main way in which they get news. So on average, across all the 36 countries, a third of 18 to 24s say social media is their main source of news, which is more than news sites on the internet, and it's more than television news. So that's a quite an interesting change if you think about how people get their news within those contexts. So if you work for a traditional media organisation, I guess many of you work for a traditional media organisation, so either a broadcaster or a print newspaper, what do those two things mean? What is the change to more internet and less traditional media, the fall of print, what does that mean in terms of share? What does it mean in terms of influence? So this is just an example from the UK, just to show how what the weekly reach is of some media brands in the UK online and offline. So by traditional, this is they're either broadcasters or they're print newspapers. So you can see that ITV News, which is the second biggest broadcaster in the UK, has around a third of people who are tuning in at least once a week to watch television news through ITV News. They were the second biggest brand in the UK for many years. Online, they have 2% reach. And there's a reason for that. They never invested in online, and they never invested consistently in online news. And that lack of investment means that if the trends continue and people watch television news less and they're not investing anything in online, they will become, in a news sense, pretty much irrelevant within 5 to 10 years. And then the Sun and the Mirror, for various reasons, also didn't invest very much early into digital, and you can see they broadly have a reach online about half of what they have offline. So generally, media companies, because of the greater competition online, are losing reach. So they're losing reach and losing influence. However, there are some exceptions. So some media companies have invested much more in digital and have found, and this may be true in your organizations as well, that you can actually get greater reach than you could get through purely print. So The Guardian, for example, now in the UK, partly because of falling print sales in our service, around 4% will buy The Guardian once a week. But they reach 14% online. They've invested very heavily. They use social media techniques. They've really gone for a reach agenda, and one that gets at young people as well. And The Telegraph until recently was like that as well, though they've been doing slightly less well on online. So huge challenges for media companies. The second thing I wanted to address was the question of sort of fake news and the role of trust. And obviously in the last year or so, this whole term of fake news has kind of dominated the discourse. So politicians have talked about it. The media has taken it up as a label. And so it's become something that everyone's talking about. Academics have started to try and define what fake news really is and really isn't, which is a very hard thing to do. But our approach at the moment is to really start thinking about this in a slightly different way from the bottom up. So what is it that ordinary people make of this term fake news? So here's just a few quotes from some focus groups we did about 6 months ago, where we talked to people in different countries about how they see the term fake news. Do they see it as a real thing? What is fake news? So I mean, I hope you could hear some of that. Sorry, the sound wasn't great. But lots and lots of different points there about fake news. The fact that, you know, the whole idea of fake news is fake, to the idea that actually fake news and the denigration of the media is making the reputation of the news media even worse, and is leading to declining trust. Lots of different sort of points in there. When we looked at all the different comments around fake news from a bottom-up sense, these are some of the things that we think we heard. So we have to separate out the different things that people are talking about. So sometimes people, when they talk about fake news, mean that journalists make things up. It's actually about poor journalism, so that they are not reporting accurately, or they're reporting in a misleading way, or things like clickbait quite often they will define as fake news. So there's a lot of responsibility there in journalism. Secondly, there's a whole idea of propaganda and spin. So sometimes that's about politicians. Sometimes it's about the way in which the media picks up those politicians' agenda and spins stories with a political agenda. That's a massive part of what people are talking about in our focus groups about fake news. The third thing is the whole sort of fabrication, so manipulated ads that pretend to be about something, and people see that as fake news, so they often come up as news stories, or they make up news stories, like the example of Donald Trump being endorsed by the Pope or whatever. And then there's some other things like parody and satire. People are very clear that that is not fake news, even though it is fabricated. People are very clear that that's something distinct from fake news. So this is satire. It's something that's funny. It may be made up, but it's made up, and people laugh about it. And then the other thing is this whole idea of it being weaponized, that people can see through what politicians are doing and what the media is doing, is using the whole term fake news for their own purposes and for their own agendas. So it's a really, really complicated picture. But we think it's quite helpful to sort of separate these things out, because only if you separate them out can you start to deal with some of the issues. We asked about this in last year's Digital News Report survey. So we asked a question about whether people feel that social media does a good job in separating fact from fiction, with the idea that some of this has got worse because of social media. And only about a quarter of people felt that social media did a good job in separating fact from fiction. And they pointed to things like the endorsement of Donald Trump by Pope Francis. In the comments, people talk about how social media has become this sort of petri dish for ideological fake news, so some of those sort of ideas of spin. And they also, a big sort of theme of this is the way in which people sort of share in a very dumb way. So they share without reading things, and they are sort of perpetuating fake news through their own actions. So actually, you know, individuals are to blame, as well as politicians, as well as sort of biased media companies. And social media and fake news are, so the implications of this are for people is, on the one hand, we found that some people felt that as a result of this, well, we better stick to reliable news sources. So there was actually that tendency. But we also found a counter tendency was that it would be much better to seek alternative sources. The more sources, the better, because we can't trust anything, so we might as well, you know, do our own research. So I think, you know, some people are taking one approach, some are the other, but it's still forming, really. People are still working out how to adapt to this sort of change to the media ecosystem, where they feel they can't believe everything they read. And maybe they never could, but some of this is obviously new, and some of it relates to social media. In terms of, we asked the same question for mainstream media, and here we find a slightly higher percentage who say that the news media does a good job in separating fact from fiction, but it's still not exactly a ringing endorsement. Only 40% think that news media does a good job, which is kind of odd, because you know, that's our job as journalists, is to separate fact from fiction, and some of them say that. On the other hand, the people who do think that the news media does a good job, I think there's something to build on here. They talk about the transparency, they talk about the credibility, the fact there are names attached, the individual journalists, the fact that there are bylines, the fact there are editors, there are complaints processes. And I think ultimately this is something that the media can really build a lot more on, this distinction between how the news media is different from the media that they see in social media. How you can distinguish between these in more visible ways, I think, is something that not just media companies but also platforms are really sort of thinking about very hard right now in terms of solutions. More generally, we ask about the question of trust, which obviously is related to the whole question of fake news. And we ask about this in the survey we've asked for a few years now across countries. So what percentage agree that you trust the media most of the time? And what you see from this chart is very wide variation. So you've got sort of Finland, Brazil, Portugal on the left here. And then at the other end, you've got Greece and Korea with trust levels around 23%. Only 23% say that they strongly agree or agree that the media there is trustworthy most of the time. And a lot of the reason for that is that the media there is seen as too close to politicians and is just not seen as credible. fact, Greece is the only place where social in our survey where social media was seen as more credible than the mainstream media. Some interesting sort of sub-stories in there. So firstly, the UK, we found that trust is actually down by 7 percentage points in a year. I think a lot of that's to do with Brexit. I'll talk about that in a second. And then in the US, so trust 38%, so relatively low. But one of the interesting things there is that the trust in the sources that you yourself use is much higher, so 53%. So quite a big gap. And what we see in countries that have very polarized media is quite a big gap between trust in general, i.e. most of the news is rubbish, but the one I use is really good, suggests that there's a lot of polarization going on. And one of the things that we do, and your country may be covered in this report, you might want to have a look at it, I'm not going to show all of them, is we thought we would try and visualize what polarization looks like in different countries this year. And the way we did that was we asked people where they self-identified as, you know, do you consider yourself to be very left-wing, very right-wing, in the middle, slightly left, slightly right, etc. And then we mapped that on to consumption figures. So we looked at what brands people were consuming, and then we put all that together and we put it on a left-right map. So we've got left on the there, we've got right there, we've got a midpoint, which remember is not the Institute deciding where these brands go. It's individuals decide based on what percentage of people are using each of those brands. And this is what the US looks like. So broadly, what we find is that there actually is a whole load of brands who are on the liberal left, who are effectively super representing the left-hand side, the liberal part of the US. And there is only one brand representing the right. And I think this really helps to explain a lot of the anger, actually, on the right against the media, that they feel that the media is not representing them. Of course, since then, there have been some hyper-partisan websites to try and fill that gap. Most of them, actually, on the right, we've only tracked Breitbart. But you can see the size of the bubble there. Breitbart is actually as big as many of these brands on the left. So it's pretty significant. This is just online. I should say these are online brands, and so we've really just looked at online brands. What we're planning to do this year is to track a few more of them, but again, specifically focusing on online. There are other people who are looking at tracking them in an actual sense, so they're looking at actual hits on them. We're obviously asking about this in a survey. What are people saying? So people on the right basically say things like, Fox News keeps it fair, CNN tells us left-wing lies. These brands are so far to the left, they might fall off. But basically, if you are over here, that's how it looks. So it's not an unreasonable point of view. And essentially, if you look at the vast bulk of the data, people on the political right are almost three times as likely to distrust the media in the US as people on the left. So it's really interesting to see that polarization and then how the media polarization fits in with that story. So should we have a look at the UK? So quite interesting to see how the UK looks as a different story. So same idea, the size of the bubbles is the size of usage, and where it sits on the spectrum depends on how many people from the left or from the right are using each particular brand. So broadly, what we see in the UK is, I put the brand names on, I was going to ask you which brands they were, but I've got ahead of myself. So broadly, quite a good range. Actually, you know, there is often a perception that the media is right-wing and is dominated by the right. And I think one of the things that's happened, particularly, remember, we're looking here not at print, we're looking at online, is a lot of the newer brands have taken, are appealing more to younger people and to the left. That's what some of these brands are here on the left. So BuzzFeed, Huffington Post, those kind of brands. But within the traditional, you've got sort of left-wing brands like The Guardian on one side, you've got The Mail Online on the other side, Times, Telegraph will be on the right, etc. So reasonable mix, but the big sort of bubble in the middle is essentially a public service broadcaster that is kind of trying to hold the facts together. And in total, 70% of people in the UK are using the BBC News either online or on television or radio. So there is a single brand which 70% of people are using once a week. Very different to the US, where you don't have that sort of single sense of an agenda going across. I'm not saying this is good or bad. I'm just saying this is what we have. There's a big difference. What we've also seen, of course, is the rise of hyper-partisan websites in the UK. With the advent of Brexit and the rise of social media, we've got now Breitbart actually is pretty small, but is one of the right brands. Most of the brands in the UK are on the left, and they've sprung up as sort of alternatives to what people perceive as bias against the left. Canary is the best known, and there's been quite a lot of stories about the Canary. So it's mainly distributed through social media. It has a reasonably sized audience, at least at the time we did this survey, but there are actually many more now, and again, we're planning to plot more of those. What's interesting is the brands in the middle, because the debate has become so polarized in the UK around Brexit, the BBC is getting stick from both sides. Ate may feel this is familiar in Finland, I don't know. The sort of public broadcaster in the middle often gets squeezed at a time of greater polarization. So here's somebody on the right saying, I used to trust and value the BBC News, but now it's just a mouthpiece for liberal leftists. This is obviously in the context of the Brexit debate. And also in the context of the Brexit debate, the BBC supports, effectively, this person is saying the BBC supports UKIP, which was supporting Brexit. So what we find is it's more difficult, potentially more difficult for those brands that have tried to take a fair and balanced picture in the middle at a time of polarization. Just one more, so we'll just look at Germany, which is actually quite a different story. So the first thing is the bubbles are smaller. What you have here is a mix of public service broadcasters. Public broadcasting is much more fragmented because there's a number of public broadcasters, so you don't have a big bubble. You actually have three or four different public broadcasters. And it's much more constrained. The debate is much more constrained as well. And that is also reflected in the comments. So in Germany, people feel not so much that there are lots of extreme views being held. There's almost no hyper-partisan sites in Germany, by the way. And they have very strict sort of anti freedom of speech and race hate laws in Germany. As a result, actually, people feel that the German media is almost too close to the politicians. Sometimes people call this sort of corporatist, that it's not prepared to sort of go outside the consensus. It's much too constrained. So there's a lot that's hushed up in the media, for example, and specifically around refugees and immigration. I don't always trust the media, especially in matters relating to the refugee crisis. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in Germany over the next few years to see whether that gap gets filled by within the law, but within a greater spectrum of opinion. The German media has kept things very, very constrained over the last 10, 15 years. Final thing about trust is we asked this year about how brands are trusted for different types of things. And in a way, the internet has made that even more obvious. So because there's so many brands, online brands try and specialize much more in one or two different things. So again, this is just the UK as an example. But we asked about different attributes. So firstly, how good is a brand at accurate and reliable news, helping me understand the world around me, strong opinions, or amusing and entertaining? So these different aspects of news use. And what you see is the BBC is not only large, but 70% of its users think it is the best brand in the UK for accurate and reliable news, the best brand they use for accurate and reliable news, and very good at helping people to understand. This is something that public service broadcasters sort of chart they would like, I think. But what you see is that The Guardian, only 21% of Guardian readers think it's the best brand for accurate and reliable news. Now, that's because, obviously, when you only had a single paper, you would think it was the best for accurate and reliable news. But now Guardian readers are using a whole range of brands, including the BBC, and they find The Guardian best for strong opinions and helping me make up my mind and those kind of things. They're not really looking for The Guardian to do accurate and reliable news as much. And then BuzzFeed News, which, by the way, in the UK has been absolutely brilliant this year in investigating all kinds of things and throwing a lot of money at investigative journalism, is not seen as credible for accurate and reliable news by most people who use it. whereas 55% think it's the best for amusing and entertaining content. So I think this is an example of two things. One is that in an online world, you need to be much more clear about which need state you're satisfying. I think be much clearer about what your strategy is for online as well. And again, the difference between, I think it also emphasizes the role of public broadcasters in doing things that commercial models are increasingly pushing towards certain types of content that might reward commercial return for strong opinions, for example, or for amusing and entertaining content. Who is going to do the investigations and all the rest of it, I think is a key question. Okay, so moving on to social media, and I think one of the most interesting stories this year is the changing nature of social media. This is actually the picture over the last 5 years, but what you see is, again, really strong growth in pretty much every country we look at. Spain more than the US, actually the UK only about halfway down in this chart. But the interesting thing is how that's flattening out. So for the first time, we've seen in about half of our countries a decline in the use of social media for news. And so the biggest decline, say Greece, Sweden -5, Germany -2. So they're pretty small declines, but it's significant in a number of countries. And I think there's three things going on. So one is the sense I get from the focus group work is that people feel that their feeds are getting a bit polluted. They're not providing enough signal from the noise in a way that maybe they were a year ago. Secondly, Facebook have changed algorithms a bit. And thirdly, to reward friends and family over professional news content. And then thirdly, we're seeing a shift towards messaging applications, which I think is really interesting. And I think we're going to see more of over the next few years. So just putting the detail on that, overall, if you look across all 36 countries, as is the average, 70% are using Facebook. So Facebook dominates, basically. When we talk about social media for news, for most people that means Facebook. Over half of Facebook users are using it for news. That's the light blue. YouTube is used a lot, but not very much for news, much less for news, only 22% for news. Instagram is the fastest growing network, but very much with young people. Twitter is obviously very important to Donald Trump, but is essentially still for influencers. And those are the big social networks. If you put together Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, and Facebook Messenger, 80% of people now use a Facebook product weekly for any purpose. So the extent to which we are products of Facebook as individuals is enormous. And that's obviously one of the reasons that the whole debate about how big these platforms are and what role they are is such a key issue. And here's the messaging apps. So you've got 40% who use WhatsApp for any purpose now. Now, when we started tracking this, it was tiny. So in the last few years, that's enormously grown. It's more in some countries than in other countries. 15% use WhatsApp for news. It was 8% last year with a slightly smaller sample of countries. So that's a really, really significant growth in 1 year. And then those are some other key messaging applications. As I say, it's quite variable. So in some countries, like the United States, actually, not many people use WhatsApp, even though it was born there. And not many people use it for news. But where's Doreen? In Kenya, right, it's kind of default for sharing news as well as for... whereas in the UK, people wouldn't use it very much for news. And in Malaysia, you can see here, 51% of people are using it for news. 51% of our sample are using it for news. And we kind of think that part of this, there's two reasons for the growth of WhatsApp. One, in some countries, Facebook is essentially bundling in free WhatsApp into phone contracts. So they're bribing people to use WhatsApp effectively. So if you use other social networks, then you have to pay. But if you use WhatsApp, you get it for free. So that's true in Brazil and many much of Latin America. The second thing is that it offers a more private space to do communication, to talk openly about what you want in countries where it can be dangerous to do so. So Malaysia would be an example, Turkey would be an example, where we've seen a significant increase in WhatsApp use. It's not on the list, but it's in there somewhere. It is significant numbers. I'm looking at Servet. Increase in Turkey.
15 to 23.
15 to 23, yeah. So... It's because it got nudged out, you see, by all these Latin countries. That's the problem. So social, I think, is really interesting because it's changing, but it also has been, you know, one of the key disruptors to the news industry for the last 5 years. The second big disruptor, and they go hand in hand, is mobile. And when I was doing the BBC News website, we launched a site. Julian will probably remember this in 1999. It was one of the first mobile websites called a WAP site. We had to go to editorial policy and get permission. It was about 0.00% of our users were using mobile. The morning after Brexit, 80% of all of the traffic to the BBC News website was from mobile phones, from smartphones, people picking up the first news on their mobile phone. And then in general in the UK, what you've seen is a growth of this is the smartphone here. So this is the percentage now to around 50% of people using the mobile phone for news. And that's grown from around 25% in 2013, so pretty much doubled. And at the same time, fewer people are using the computer or the laptop for news, which seems like really strange, because it's not like there are fewer laptops or computers. There's still the same number, roughly. It's just that people always have their phone with them. It's more convenient just to pick up your phone when you're at home rather than the computer. So people here, put up your hand if you got your news first via the smartphone this morning, if the first news you got was from the smartphone. And put up your hand if the first news you got was from television or radio or print. Okay, so there's a generational difference here. Generational difference. This is a slightly older audience, but in general, it's critical, right? The smartphone is becoming critical. It's the first way in which people get their news. It's always with you. It's personal. It's multifunctional. It's incredibly convenient. 46% of people are using their smartphones to access news in bed, which is incredibly scary. Actually, more scary is this one. 32% accessing the smartphones in the bathroom or the toilet for news. I have been known, but I try not to do it. So what does that mean for publishers? You know, how has this manifested itself? This is a chart from the Financial Times, from their log files, which shows essentially when people access, what time of day people are accessing news now. And what you see is essentially a new prime time. So this has literally emerged in the last 3 or 4 years. So previously, people used to access the internet in the office, and they used to read newspapers or watch radio and television here. But this is essentially why the competition is now with radio and television, because that's when people are accessing through the smartphone and the tablet. And they're coming in for quite short periods of time as well. So it's quite challenging. And when do you think the Financial Times journalists would file their stories? So where on this pattern would people actually file stories? Yeah, some of them would file it Sunday night for Monday, but if they were on a daily schedule, what sort of time of day do you think they... In the afternoons, yeah, it's kind of somewhere around here, right? So this was... this was really the kind of the mismatch that they noticed. So you had essentially this new prime time happening here, but people were still effectively filing for print deadlines at the end of the day. So broadly, they saw this chart and made a whole load of changes as a result. First of all, they said this makes absolutely no sense. We need at least a portion of our journalists to be filing stories to hit this deadline here. So they kind of moved people to Hong Kong so that they could actually deliver news at the right time, but they also changed the format of the news because they noticed that people here were coming in for very short periods of time, so that not necessarily wanting 10,000 word articles or 2,000 word articles or whatever it was. So what they did was they created different products, so things like Fast FT, which is kind of a breaking news response to people wanting something different on mobile. And that's what people are trying to get their heads around right now. It's not necessarily the same thing at a different time. It's actually maybe people want a different format as well as a different time. So mobile, I think, is really disruptive in lots of different ways. I'll come back to that. Third big disruptor. The social is one disruptor. Mobile is the second disruptor. The third big disruptor is kind of visual formats or visual journalism. So the internet, when we started in 97... I think we were only allowed to have one animated GIF, it was called an animated GIF, one picture effectively that moved on the front page of the website. Because at that time, people's connectivity was really bad, and we used to fight about which one it should be and all the rest of it. But now, effectively, the internet for most people is can deliver high-definition television. I mean, it's become a video-enabled internet. But that doesn't necessarily mean people want video. But what it does is it means opens up the possibility of telling stories not just with words, but with a range of rich visual formats. And you know, part of the industry's response is to say, well, let's just throw a lot of video at people. And broadly in our surveys, we find that video is actually not growing as fast as people think, that a lot of the reasons for that are driven by commercial reasons, not necessarily by what audiences want. If you look at what audiences want, audiences tell us in terms of preference on the internet, even though the video it's video enabled now, the internet, and there's lots of video around, over two-thirds of us still prefer text. So the dark blue is mostly text, you prefer mostly text, and then equal, the mauve in the middle is text and video, so equally, and then if you prefer video, that's the blue. So you can see that text is still incredibly important, and we shouldn't forget text. And the reason for that is that when you're in this sort of lean forward mode, when you're actively looking for information, the most important thing is speed. It's getting and control. That you are in control, you get to what you want really, really quickly. Now, video is important, is becoming more important, and is a great way of telling stories if it's really dramatic, if it's breaking news, if the story can only be told in video, all of those things. But broadly, it's a secondary thing when you're in lean forward mode. If you're using the internet to distribute linear television programming and you're sitting back, obviously it's the reverse. But this, in terms of news, the preference is still for text. It's just worth remembering that. Okay, so then just finally on this first bit is the business model challenges. And obviously all of these disruptors, so social, video, and mobile, have disrupted again, and in a much bigger way, the business models of media companies. The first thing to say is that the ad model is breaking down. So the idea of adjacent display, having an ad next to text, which is what worked in print, didn't really ever work on a computer, but it definitely doesn't work on a mobile screen. And so that's one reason. The second reason is that people always hated ads, but they couldn't do anything about it. Now they hate ads, and they can do something about it because they can actually block your ads. So this whole idea, which has grown in the last 2-3 years, is individual consumers can install a piece of software to block all ads. Running on across all countries at 24%. If you're trying to reach young people, good luck. 53% are blocking ads on average now for under 35s. Not so much on mobile yet. There's a whole load of reasons why that's not quite taken off, but we've seen a whole load of developments in the last few weeks with Safari and Chrome, who are going to be blocking by default a whole range of ads that Google consider and Apple consider unacceptable. So ad blocking is part of the furniture. It's here to stay. It's going to be a very significant disruption to the business models. And then there's a whole load of other problems with ads, so fraud, fake ads, the fact that the publishers only get a very small percentage of the ads that that the brands set. So there's a whole load of people in the chain who are taking away some of that revenue. And then, of course, Facebook and Google taking a lot of the revenue as well. So all of this together means that some of the newer companies that are thinking not about ads, they're thinking about branded content or other ways of getting of financing what they do. So BuzzFeed or Vice, for example, are doing pretty well. They have these crazy valuations of billions. Whereas in general, you see old media companies cutting staff and really struggling. So The Guardian, for example, operating losses around 50 million a year, 20% cuts in staff last year. The Independent closed its print operation and lost 50% of its journalists in the process. This is just UK. And public service broadcasters like the BBC are under huge pressure in most parts of the world, not in every part of the world, but in most parts of the world. So the BBC News, for example, is supposedly having to make £80 million worth of cuts in the next 5 years. So on the one hand, you have new models, and then you have old models under huge strain from some of the changes that I've talked about. Coupled with the fact that very few people are prepared to pay for online news. So on average, only around 10% or 13% are prepared to pay for online news. The highest in Norway, so 26% pay weekly for online news in Norway, and the lowest in the UK and Greece, 6%. So one of the reasons why very few people pay for news in the UK is because very few people are trying to charge for news. So it's English-speaking language, so there's a surfeit of news from any provider, so why you should pay for any particular provider, it's very hard to see why you do that. And a lot of it, as you say, is free. So here's somebody in our focus groups. While it's free, I'll happily not pay for it. If there was a concerted effort, if everyone did it, I think I would pay. So there is kind of potential to get people to pay more, but it's very hard to see how those mechanisms are going to work. The only country where we have seen a change in the last year is in the United States. So here what we saw was an increase of 7% in the likelihood of people, the percentage of people who were actually paying. So from around 10% to 16% say that they are prepared to pay. And a lot of that is essentially politically driven. So it's under 35s, it's people on the political left wanting to support organizations like the Washington Post, New York Times, New Yorker, etc. And so they are piling in and paying for subscriptions. Now, whether that will last is another question. It might just be a bump and it might finish. But at least in this country, in the US, we have seen people investing in digital subscriptions. Interestingly, a lot of those people from the, not just from the left, but also younger. And one of the things we find is that people who are under 35 are maybe paying for Netflix or Spotify. So they actually they see the value of paying for services on the internet, whereas people of my generation are just never going to pay for news. So really old people, they pay, and young people pay, but people in the middle are not paying. So it's quite interesting. A lot of the New York Times growth has come from that under 35 over the last few years. So that's a good sign, potentially, for the news industry. Okay, so just finally, I'm going to talk about, very briefly, five quick trends for the future. So that was just a big overview of some of the data that we've been collecting over the last few years. What are some of the key trends? What are the disruptors? And what are the impact on the business side? Here are just a few thoughts about things that might happen going forwards. So firstly, because of the growing importance of the mobile and the fact that it's becoming much more central to people's lives, I think the lock screen of the mobile is going to become absolutely critical, is becoming critical. It's often the gateway to the internet. The first thing you do when you wake up is look at that lock screen. Previously it was apps, now it's kind of come up a level to the lock screen. And the phone companies, or sorry, the operating systems, Apple and Android, are also introducing a whole load of new functionality into the lock screen. So it's not just a little text message, but there's also little pictures that go with it. And there's also now the possibility of putting richer media into there, so cards that tell stories in their own right, with the ability then to share that without ever going anywhere near the app itself. So it's almost like an intermediate layer between an alert message and real content. So people are just starting to do things with that. So you can even put video directly onto the lock screen. So here's how it works. You can play a video effectively somewhere in between your app and the mobile notification. So I think this is going to be a really significant. You can see how fast mobile alerts have grown in the last few years. That may stabilize this year. It'll be interesting to see, or it may continue to grow. But I think this is going to be critical because people essentially need attention. How are you going to get attention for your brand? How are you going to remind them to come back regularly? And people have been sending out a lot more alerts. The second thing is the emergence of voice. So people are talking about what comes beyond the touch screen. We've got used to the mobile and the touch screen as a way of accessing news and information. But in the future, we're just going to be able to talk to the internet. So we won't need any kind of touch. We won't need any interface. We can just ask questions. And the first sort of really commercially applicable version of that is these voice-connected speakers. Has anyone got one? Anyone got a voice? So Amazon Alexa or Google Home? Yeah, it's a bit weird. Talking to computers is weird. But I can guarantee you some of us are going to be talking, more of us are going to be talking to computers over the next few years. So, for example, Alexa, play me the latest episode of my favorite BBC program. You can see how that's a really useful thing that saves you time to get directly to the information that you want, or my latest podcast. Fact-checking. Do we send £350 million to Brussels each week, which is a very topical discussion point in the UK? You could ask Alexa. Would you trust Alexa, or who would you trust to give you that answer in a voice-activated world? Very interesting question. Did the Holocaust happen? So there's actually a YouTube video of this where I think it's asking Google Home that question, and you don't get a very satisfactory answer, which shows the possibilities of misinformation within voice as well as information. What's the weather in Oxford? All this stuff. Is my flight on time? So you start to see how this will be really useful. I think it's going to be really important because it solves a real problem. Audio has basically, the internet's not really worked for audio. Audio, I think, is a really powerful medium because you can do other things at the same time as listening. And the problem has been Facebook, for example, doesn't really support audio. You can't find things on the internet. And this really solves a problem of audio discoverability. But I also think it's going to be a medium in its own right. I think that sense of little bits of information and asking for bits of information and checking bits of information is going to be critical. So I think it's going to be an interesting space over the next few years. I think the third thing is people are talking about a lot about virtual reality and more immersive media. I think some of this is going to be quite niche. This is The Guardian's first efforts at virtual reality. So this was try and give people a sense of what it was like in a solitary confinement. So that you put your headphones on and you could sort of really feel the space with sound and all the rest of it. So the sound and so you can go and look at this online. There's lots of great examples of really immersive media which can tell stories in powerful and different ways. And again, all of this is kind of enabled by very, very powerful broadband and connectivity. But there are sort of other ways of doing this. This is, one of the things that media companies are really looking for is for people to spend time with them. So in a news story, you might spend 10, 15 seconds, and that's not really enough to sell advertising or get loyalty. So this is an example of it's like a web documentary. This was done by the BBC, and it was about a massacre that happened some time ago. But it's very strictly templated, it's very visual, it has bits of video in it. It allows you to explore at your own pace and really to build up significant amounts of time. So some of these types of stories, these immersive stories, have dwell times of about 5 minutes. So the average dwell time, I think, of this one was 5 minutes, whereas an ordinary story would be 10 to 15 seconds. So immersive and long form is something that people are really thinking about. And then, of course, at the other end, how do you tell stories effectively on these very small screens? So how can you tell stories that are visual, that are quick, that are really intuitive to the mobile interface? Again, this is another BBC story, but it's about people who are going to a ball. So basically students, at the end of their time as a student, they go and have a party. And this is just a story of somebody who raised money so that they didn't have to buy their own dress. And basically what you do is you swipe through it. It's a very, very quick story where each screen tells you something different. Everything's visual, 1 point per story, a little bit like a slideshow in many ways. And then do you like the article at the end? So it's very different from writing a sort of scripted article. And obviously this kind of idea has been pioneered within Snapchat Discover and Twitter Moments and is now being applied by a lot of media companies right now. Can you tell stories in more compelling ways, in more visual ways? In some cases, just really, really simple storytelling with graphs. So it's visual. You don't need to write 800 words to tell the story of where this hurricane is going to hit next. So some of it can be very simple, some of it's very complicated. But I think it's about this idea that people are short of time. And how can you tell that story in ways that is useful to them and get information over much more quickly than using words? The other thing is, so this is just an example of compressed storytelling. So Snapchat, for example, is actually reaching people and really engaging young people in particular very heavily. So 23% of 18-24s are using Snapchat Discover, so this kind of swipe mechanisms for news. Okay, then the fifth one is, I guess, the idea of audience-first news agendas. This idea started with the New York Times, who, with their innovation report in 2014, the first one, concluded that they had brilliant content, but that wasn't enough, that they couldn't get it to their readers, and that what they were really bad at was taking that content to where people were, adapting it so that it was in the right format, at the right place. And this is a really big idea which media companies have started to engage with and do something about. So broadly, that's involved creating these teams called audience engagement teams, and their job is to take the journalism and reformat it, or to create some buzz around it, and to feed that back into the newsroom, this whole sort of idea of audience engagement, to drive real-time insight, distribute it to the right people at the right time. And quite often what that means is having technology people in the newsroom, so it's not just done by conventional journalists, but you're mixing skills to enable that to happen. So people who understand data, people who understand social media, marketing people, you put them together with journalists. This is quite a big and difficult idea. I think it's a really important trend. Audience first agenda. This is some of the top search terms in the UK the day after the Brexit vote. So after the Brexit vote, we wanted to know, apparently, what is the EU, what is a single market, what is a customs union? It would be quite good if we could have explained this stuff beforehand. And the idea of audience first engage is, instead of telling people about the minutiae of things so you're really bored before it, you actually answer these questions beforehand by using audience first agendas. And I think what it's doing is it's leading to people to really rethink their assumptions in the newsrooms about what people want. Having data in the newsroom telling people what people are interested in is quite challenging, but it's really starting to rethink the arrogance in many ways, the we know best arrogance. Secondly, I think we're starting to see incorporating this sort of wider agenda of stories that are demanded by young people. So people are interested in a lot of other things apart from the things that we've traditionally felt were important to tell them about. And we've seen the growth of all kinds of new kinds of journalism, explanatory journalism, solutions-based journalism. These are some of the new buzz phrases that are going around. I'll skip through that, but there's an example. So around the UK election now, there are just all these explainers, what you need to know, what is a snap election? So the BBC and others were basically writing a lot of stories responding to questions before the election this time because of what happened with Brexit. So they changed what they did. There's a lot of videos that basically try and explain really complicated questions like who are the Rohingyas in Myanmar through video and compelling first narrative storytelling, and taking that content into social media in the formats that people want to see it, so explanatory journalism. And then finally, I can't finish this look at the future without talking about artificial intelligence, which I think probably it's a collection of a lot of different technologies, but I think it's going to transform a lot of newsrooms over the next 5 to 10 years. So that's partly about using data more effectively and bringing it in to help you define how to take the right content to people at the right time. It's about understanding more about audiences so that you can profile who they are to be able to deliver that content. But it's also about equipping your journalists differently. So one of the problems we have as journalists is that we have all these things happening all over the world. There's more sources that we have to monitor 24 hours a day, and it's really hard. And so if we could have tools that helped us in real time and alerted us when something was really important in our particular beat to what was trending at a particular time, it would make our jobs much easier as journalists. So I think organizations like Shipstead are creating a whole load of tools for journalists to make them more efficient. And they will use some of these techniques of artificial intelligence, effectively intelligent agents, computer-assisted, to help you do a better job, to help you identify what's worth looking at a particular time, as well as what stories people are using at a particular time, which is this application here. And finally, just as a scary thought, this is an example of how in the future we can create videos. Well, actually today you can create videos out of text stories. So you can turn a text story into a video automatically. So in the way in which we produce news, artificial intelligence and a whole load of computer-assisted techniques are going to be deployed to make stuff quicker, to make bad content, good content. This is an example of a text story that was turned automatically into a video with some software called Wibbits. So that's essentially taking a text story and then mapping it to various templated ideas to create a video, which is scary stuff, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not saying you're all redundant. It's just that we will need to get used to how we can use these techniques to make us more efficient. So what does it all mean? So firstly, going back to the data I looked at earlier, traditional media companies risk losing relevance unless they put digital at the heart of what they do, number one. Secondly, right now, the smartphone is absolutely the key device of the digital age. It needs to be the focus of media company strategies. Obviously, you need to keep an eye on what's coming next as well, which I think may well be voice. Thirdly, don't just think about words. Visual journalism, and by that I don't just mean video, will become more important, along with more compressed journalism, more explanatory journalism. I think the rise of artificial intelligence opens up lots of possibilities, from automated production to more personalized and relevant communication to your users. But there will be a lot of resistance along the way. So this is a kind of the next big disruption, I think, after social, mobile, visual. I think AI is the next big disruption. And then the final point is that, you know, I've talked a lot about technology and embracing change. And I think that involves new platforms, it involves new formats, it involves a more open tone. But I think you also need to stay absolutely true to your core mission and values. Because if you don't have that, none of the rest of it is worth it. So this is more about formatting. The values have to remain as strong as ever. Thank you very much.